Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore.
And good morning once again. Jeff sitting in for Rich today. Rich is out with a little bit under the weather, so we'll be talking. I'll be talking today with Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore on Legal Talk. Gordon, thank you so much for coming in today.
Wonderful to be here, Jeff. Good morning, and I hope Rich feels better soon.
Yeah, he didn't sound too well last night when he called me, so we were hoping he recovers his voice and gets back to feeling to 100%. There's a lot of interesting things that we could be talking about today, but we're going to keep the focus kind of narrowed to a couple of different issues, and it's not going to be too narrow. We're going to be talking probably broadly about them. Why don't we start off? There has been a high-profile case here in Minnesota, a couple of youths that have been accused of murder. Actually, 15 and 17, I believe, the district attorney or the prosecuting attorney, I should say, worked out a plea deal, but the attorney general for Minnesota stepped in. That's it kind of generally. Let me turn that over to you, and maybe you can help us understand what's going on there.
Right. That's the case that's been in the media, and it's a case that's pending right now, and because of that, I can't talk about the specifics of that case or express any opinions regarding it, but it did prompt some thoughts on my part to talk today about the question fundamentally of who's the prosecutor in our court system. I mean, who is the attorney that is the person who is bringing a criminal charge and prosecuting it either in state or federal court or in against adults or juveniles? Now, the listeners need to remember that we have a dual system of federalism in our country, where we have a federal court system and we have a state court system. I'm obviously a representative of the latter, the state court system. The federal court system exists to handle cases involving federal constitutional issues, federal statutory issues, claims between states, and other types of jurisdiction that I don't need to get into today. But for purposes of criminal law, basically to get into federal court, the prosecutor has to have a federal case, meaning a violation of a federal crime or a claim related to some type of federal constitutional question that gets into federal court. So in the state system here, we're talking about crimes that have been defined by the Minnesota legislature, and those are cases that go to the state court system. Now, who is the prosecutor of those cases? Well, it depends. Depends generally on the level of offense. In Minnesota, we have, I guess, what we could call a three-tier level of offenses, starting with the least serious. Those are petty misdemeanors. Those are your infractions, your parking tickets, dog running at large, trash disposed the wrong way. These are usually municipal ordinances or other state laws that don't provide for a jail sentence as an offense. It's a fine only sort of thing. They're technically not criminal, but they are infractions. Those are prosecuted generally by a lawyer that's employed by a city called a city attorney. Now, in some bigger cities, we have in-house city attorneys. You go to Minneapolis, the Minneapolis city attorney has a staff of attorneys. In most jurisdictions, however, the city attorney is an attorney with whom the city council contracts to provide prosecution services. So if the city has a population of over 600, the city has primary responsibility over prosecuting petty misdemeanor and misdemeanor crimes. For real small towns, really small municipalities, the city council can request the county attorney to do those. And oftentimes, city government governments enter into contracts with the county attorney to prosecute those kind of offenses. In rare circumstances, there are some cases where the city attorney can request the assistance of the attorney general to handle certain types of non-felony gun cases, but those are pretty rare. gross misdemeanor crimes are the next level. We have petty misdemeanor. Well, I guess I should define misdemeanor. Misdemeanor are crimes that are punishable by a maximum sentence of 90 days in jail, $1,000 fine, or both. And so that's the city jurisdiction. Gross misdemeanor crimes are the next most serious offense. Those are punishable by a jail sentence of up to 1 year, a fine of $3,000, or both. Those are split between city and county attorneys depending kind of on where you are. If you're in a metro area county, the city attorney handles those cases. If you're not in a metro area county, it depends on how big the city is. Cities of the first, second, and third class, and the third class are cities of 10,000 to 20, I believe. And so those are the regional centers, the bigger cities like Northfield. The gross misdemeanors are prosecuted by the city attorney in most cases. Otherwise, the county attorney handles those cases. And obviously, anything that happens out in the county outside of municipal jurisdiction is handled by the county attorney. So then we get to felony crimes. Felonies are the most serious criminal offense in state court, punishable by a jail sentence of a year and a day or greater, and a fine that can be set by the legislature, ranging, I've seen felony crimes from $1,500 to tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars of potential fines. The felony crimes are prosecuted by the county attorneys. We have 87 separate county attorneys in the state, one per county. The county attorneys, however, also have the responsibility to handle the juvenile delinquency cases. Those are the criminal cases involving juveniles that go to state court. No city attorneys get involved in delinquency cases. Those are handled by the county attorney. And so the question, Jeff, that this case brings up is, when can an attorney general get involved in prosecuting a case that involves a felony state charge or a juvenile delinquency allegation, as is the case that you just mentioned? The county attorney has the ability to request help from the attorney general, and this happens, frankly, all the time with our rural prosecutors. And I was one of those people. I was a three-term county attorney in Nobles County, a county of about 20,000 people. Worthington was barely a city of the third class. I mean, we were in like 12,000 people. And so I had the ability as a county attorney to ask for help from the AG's office, as we call it, in cases involving, really serious charges. And I had two of those during my tenure, two child death cases, really tragic cases. Those are very complicated, involving lots of nuanced, difficult, challenging evidentiary and legal issues. And the attorney general has historically provided a backstop for county attorneys to come in and help. They have prosecutors that have vast experience and come in and do that. And when I was in the attorney general's office in the late 80s and early 90s during Skip Humphrey's tenure as county attorney, there was a robust staff of prosecutors that was working on cases in the district court at the request of county attorneys. The priorities of the attorney generals after Attorney General Humphrey changed a little bit, though, and the focus became less on helping local counties with prosecution issues. Now, the current attorney general, Keith Ellison, has made it a point to request money from the legislature to get that prosecution division back up to somewhere where it was under Attorney General Spanis and Humphrey. And I understand that effort has actually borne fruit and the legislature has approved that. But the question is, in cases where the county attorney hasn't requested help from the attorney general, hasn't asked the county attorney to step in. Like, remember, in the Derek Chauvin case, the Hennepin County attorney requested help from the attorney general, and the attorney general came in and provided that. But what about a case where that help hasn't been requested? When can the attorney general step in? Well, the law says that whenever the governor shall request in writing, the attorney general shall prosecute any person charged with an indictable offense, and in all such cases may attend upon the grand jury and exercise the county of a powers of a county attorney. Now, an indictable offense is an offense that can be charged by a through an indictment issued by a grand jury, and those are certain types of cases. This authority from the state law has been rarely exercised in any way that has been, I guess, the subject of a public court dispute. But it was once previously in recent times. In 1995, the Crow Wing County attorney was a fellow by the name of John Remington Graham. And Graham was a interesting individual who had some strong opinions about a variety of topics. If you get into looking at some of his thought processes on issues such as water fluoridation and some other matters. But in 1995, a delegation of citizens from Crow Wing County, including the sheriff and two county commissioners, requested that the attorney general and the governor review a number of instances of alleged intrafamilial criminal sexual conduct cases, which the citizens felt Graham had erroneously declined to prosecute. In other words, a disagreement about the decision to charge or not charge. And after reviewing those cases, the attorney general at the time asked Graham to appoint the county attorney as special prosecutor. John Remington Graham refused that request, and so the governor was requested to basically direct the AG to take over those cases, and that happened. The governor at that time, I believe it was Governor Carlson, if I'm not mistaken, requested that or demanded that the attorney general take over prosecution of two individuals, Anthony Eklund and Todd Davis, for alleged criminal sexual conduct. County Attorney Graham challenged that authority or that delegation, and that case went to the Supreme Court. And in 1995, the Supreme Court held that the portion of the statute that states whenever the governor shall so request in writing, the attorney general shall prosecute. The court interpreted that as a directive mandating the attorney general prosecute if a person is charged with an indictable offense, and the governor basically demands the county attorney to take over the case. And so there were some other issues in that case that weren't answered. And in the case of a juvenile delinquency case, that does create some interesting wrinkles, because generally juvenile delinquency cases are handled a little differently than adult prosecutions and normally don't involve a grand jury indictment, although I don't know if that's an impossibility. So that's the background, Jeff. It's a little bit of a kind of a long-winded one, but I think it's an interesting, I guess, tension in our system that exists, where the there is a backstop if local actors are not convinced that a county attorney is exercising discretion appropriately. There is the potential, I stress potential, for the county governor to request the AG to get involved. Now, I will say that as a county attorney, I mean, I certainly understand the concerns of the County Attorneys Association related to that. I mean, the county attorney is an elected official. The people of a particular jurisdiction elected that county attorney, presumably to exercise discretion in the way that that county attorney felt is appropriate. And so, you know, there are lots of differences of opinions in these matters, and how that discretion gets exercised is a tough call. And I don't think there is any precedent for any wholesale effort at having a attorney general take over the work of a county attorney. This is really extraordinary and unusual.
Yeah, a couple of items related to that. Number one is, do they have, we understand that you can't really talk about this particular case too much.
I can't.
But can the attorney general does have to get the permission then from the governor? It's not like a rank has its privileges. I outrank you. I'm taking this over. They are kind of separate entities, and the governor has to okay it.
Absolutely. It's got to be done in writing. The governor has to demand in writing, and the history of the statute suggests that that authority isn't exercised very often because it's really an extraordinary intrusion on the work of a local county attorney.
And is this, to the best of your knowledge, this particular incident, is this the first time since 1995 that this has come into play, or is that come a little more often, maybe in a lower profile case?
Jeff, I'd be cautious to speculate on that because I haven't done the research. But in looking in preparation for today's show, there are very, very few cases where this authority is discussed in the law. And this case from 1995 in Crow Wing County is the one that is frequently cited. That suggests to me that this authority is very rarely exercised. And normally the scenario that the Attorney General faces is, frankly, a resource-related challenge at the local level of prosecution and a request for the AG to get involved to help. And so it's a question of resources. And frankly, recently, the AG hasn't had the resources to get involved on a statewide level in every case that a local unit of government would request help in. And so they've had to exercise discretion. So it's really a bunch of, you know, discretionary calls, Jeff. And you know, I, again, want to stress the difficulty and sensitivity behind these issues. I mean, you've got obviously victims, families that are quite aggrieved and bereaved for obvious reasons. You have local law enforcement that have opinions. You have local voters who have opinions based on the election decision they made. And, you know, the county attorneys are fiercely independent. That's what we expect from county attorneys. We don't expect county attorneys to be a rubber stamp for anybody. We expect county attorneys to exercise discretion and to use good judgment under their authority. And, you know, having the governor and the AG step in to say, you know, we're taking this one away from you is a big step. Again, I expressed absolutely no opinion on the pending case as to whether it was warranted or not. I understand the policy arguments on both sides of it, and I don't want to go there right now because obviously the case is pending, and I don't want to say anything about that. But I can just say generally, Jeff, this is a very unusual situation that exists. Generally, the work with the Attorney General and the local prosecutor is very cooperative.
You're listening to Legal Talk with Associate Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota Supreme Court. Is there anything else you'd like to add about that particular case before we move on to our second topic?
I don't
today?
Think so, Jeff. I think at this point, it remains to be seen how the case that's pending is handled. And so I think because of that, the less said from me on that particular case would be better. It will be interesting as the Attorney General gets some more prosecution resources, whether what happened in this case becomes something that happens in other cases. And that's something that will have to be watched down the road. I would expect not. This authority is so extreme in the sense of, you know, stepping in and exercising authority to take away somebody else's prosecution. I don't expect to see this utilized frequently, but we'll keep an eye on this, Jeff, and perhaps when the case is concluded, we could come back and talk about it a little bit, particularly if whether there's going to be any appeal on anything. Mm-hmm. That's the key thing for me.
All right. Let's move on to our second topic today, and that is the funding of public education. We have had a number of public education officials in here who have not been happy with the way things have gone as of late. You know, there is some school districts are hard hit, especially in rural Minnesota. But the way the state helps fund public schools, that is a case that the Minnesota Constitution will probably have to weigh in on at some point, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution, the state Constitution, has been involved in a number of cases that involve challenges to how the Minnesota funds public education. Coming up on the court's calendar in May is an important case by the name of Alejandro Cruz Guzman versus State. And this is the second time the Cruz Guzman case has been before before the court, actually. It started in 2015 as a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of children enrolled in what are characterized as racially or social economically imbalanced public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so the action or lawsuit was brought against the state of Minnesota, the House of Representatives, and the Minnesota Department and Commissioner of Education. Three charter schools actually intervened along with parents in those schools as defendants to support this current system of funding education. The parents in these cases, Jeff, are alleging that the state has failed to provide an adequate education due to policies and practices that they claim have created public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul that are allegedly separate and segregated in terms of racial and socioeconomic composition. Now, this case is coming up before the court in May, and I want to make it quite clear that I'm not going to comment on the merits of anything related to it. I wasn't on the court the first time this case came through, and I'm not going to say anything about the merits of it other than to just sort of tee up the issues here. The parents of the students in the class action are seeking relief under constitutional provisions, as you say, Jeff, in Minnesota, the Education Equal Protection and Due Process clauses. Now, in 2018, this case was before the state Supreme Court. It had been thrown out at the local district court, and the court, prior to me joining, found that the claims alleging that the state has failed to provide students with inadequate education were actually justiciable in court. And so it went back to district court, and the parents moved for summary judgment at district court on the question of whether their allegations basically establish what we call a per se violation of the state education clause. And that clause provides that the legislature has the duty to establish what is stated as a general and uniform system of public schools and to make provisions to secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools. So that's the state education clause. And the parents are arguing that they don't need evidence of the state intending to create racial imbalances or any evidence of a causal link between the state's actions and the racial imbalances that they cite to in the Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools. In other words, their claim is if there's racial segregation, it's per se a constitutional violation, meaning it's a constitutional violation without any proof of intent to create that. The state is responding, saying that the parents are required to establish intent and causation, and they dispute strongly that any state policies have caused an inadequate education. In other words, I think the argument is that those decisions are made at the local level by local school boards, taxing authorities, et cetera. And so the district court ruled in favor of the state, ruling that the parents have to establish actual segregation or what's called de jure segregation to prevail on their claims under the education clause. And the parents have to establish that any challenged state action must directly cause these racial imbalance school environments. And so the court, district court certified a question to the Court of Appeals as important and doubtful. And that question is whether the education clause is violated by a racially imbalanced school system, regardless of the presence of de jure segregation. In other words, an intentional, actual segregated school system or a proof of a causal link between the imbalance in actions of the state. And this, Jeff, really goes back to, I mean, the incredibly important case of Brown versus Board of Education, where the United States Supreme Court in 1954 ruled that, you know, de jure or actually segregated school districts segregated by, you know, intent and design violate the federal constitution as a matter of law. And so there's somewhat of a similar argument that's being made here, although it's as indicated nuanced as the parents are saying that they don't have to show that anybody intended to violate anything. But if the effect of it is to create these alleged segregated districts, that's a violation of the law. And so the Court of Appeals held that a racially imbalanced school system caused by de facto segregation by itself, in other words, the result of policies rather than the intent of policies, is not a violation of the Education Clause of the Minnesota Constitution, even if state action contributed to the racial imbalance. And so That's the question, Jeff. The Court of Appeals said that a racially imbalanced school system is not a per se violation of the Education Clause unless that imbalance is caused by intentional de jure segregation of the type described in Brown versus Board of Education. And nobody's alleging that that's going on in Minnesota. There's no, you know, a policy at any level to segregate students by race in the state of Minnesota. So, you know, these get down to some really challenging questions, Jeff, related to local funding of education. You know, how we fund our schools. I saw this issue as a school board member. I have for 3 years in Worthington. I was chair of the board 1 year. And, you know, I hear Superintendent Hillman and others talking about the formula. You know, that's the state funding of public education and whether special education has been funded adequately and whether the formula is kept up with district costs. And, you know, it doesn't take too long to drive around in the state, Jeff, and look at some different schools. And, you know, people can kind of draw their own conclusions on some things, you know, frankly. I mean, you know, we have some schools in the metro area that look like, you know, colleges, frankly. And then in some of the areas of my former territory, Nobles County, I mean, literally there was one school district where the upper floor of the building had been condemned by the fire marshal. It was not usable because of, you know, inadequate fire exits. And so it literally sat there unused because of, you know, the district either not having the money or choosing to not ask the voters to spend the money to fix it. And, you know, that's that provides a significantly different environment for education. But, you know, we have traditionally valued local control of education, local decisions on, you know, referenda, funding. And, you know, those are decisions we generally leave to our local school boards and our voters. And so, you know, when the results of those decisions are, you know, create some of these challenges, where do we go? So that's coming up on May 2nd. And it, for the benefit of the audience, the case is going to be argued at the Richfield High School. We're doing one of our traveling road shows for high school students. And so it's going to be a really good case, I think, to have in front of the students there in Richfield. They're going to get to hear really some outstanding advocates. We've got top-notch lawyers that are on this case making really important arguments on both sides of this. And as indicated earlier, Jeff, I express no opinion whatsoever on the merits of the dispute. And that's not the purpose of this, but this is just to kind of make listeners aware of this important issue that's percolating again.
The event that is at Richfield, is that something of a, like a mock trial, or will this be actual testimony heard by the Supreme Court?
It'll be an actual oral argument, so no testimony. This isn't a hearing that involves the taking of evidence. This is oral arguments on written briefs that have been submitted. The parents took an appeal from that Court of Appeals decision that went against their position, and so they will be involved. The Attorney General is involved, representing the state. We have interveners, as indicated, the charter school, parents, and so we got three parties that'll be dividing up argument, and the court will hear that at Richfield High School on stage. It'll be in their auditorium, and we're getting that set up right now.
Will that be open to visitors?
You know, I don't think generally it will be. That's totally up to the Richfield School District. My guess is the answer to that is probably not. I am looking into the question of, you know, we do archive our oral arguments when they're off site. There's a few more challenges in terms of that. I would certainly hope that there's a way to do that in this particular case, to have it on our website, but I'm looking into that, and we'll let you and Rich know as to whether or not we're able to accomplish that. I'm sure there'll be media coverage of it. Given the importance of the case.
Oh, absolutely. Once again, Gordon Moore is with us, the Associate Justice on the Minnesota Supreme Court. We're talking right now about public school funding. A question that I had is that, you know, you mentioned Brown versus the Board of Education. Has there been challenges historically? Do you have some precedents on the way Minnesota funds its school? Is there anything in the background that the courts have done, have ruled upon already that might help?
Yeah, Jeff, this in I'm probably not as prepared to answer that as I should have been here. I can tell you generally that this isn't the first time that there's been a claim that the manner in which the state has funded public education doesn't meet the requirements of the Minnesota Constitution regarding its claim that or its requirement that the system of education has to be general and uniform. I don't want to talk off the cuff on that right now, but there have been prior cases that have raised questions about how our property tax-based funding of education, largely in formula-based education from the state of Minnesota, you know, is that general and uniform when, you know, there are different, you know, different levels of taxable property in communities. So they're just a different tax base, different levels of voter willingness to approve excess levy referenda and bond referenda. And those are, you know, that's our system. And maybe we can talk about this a little broader in an upcoming case where I could get my facts in a row a little bit. But the answer is yes, they're having challenges. And so far, to my knowledge, there's been no case that has successfully challenged the state system on the grounds of a alleged violation of the state education clause. This case relates a little bit more to the effects of the system in allegations of, you know, racial segregation. We have certain schools in our state that, you know, are what we call majority-minority schools. And frankly, you know, Worthington, where I was one of them. I mean, Worthington High School is, you know, 60-70%, you know, non-white kids. In our public schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's at least that, if not more. And so, you know, how does that fact affect education? I mean, is there a connection between the makeup of the student body and the type of education that students are getting? These are really difficult cases, you know. In Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court overruled its prior decision in Plessy versus Ferguson that had basically ratified separate but allegedly equal public schools as being okay under the Constitution. In other words, you know, states could racially discriminate and put non-white children in a different school district, and as long as that was allegedly, you know, equal, and I'm putting air quotes around that because, of course, it wasn't equal. That was the whole point. It was inherently unequal. And more broadly, I think there was an underlying premise behind the Brown case that having a diverse mix of students in a school contributes to the quality of education for everybody. In other words, you know, in a public school system, you know, parents have a broad variety of choices regarding where they send their students, and there's a lot of benefits of an educational system that, you know, provides for a diverse background and diverse education. And so it's these are challenging issues, and I know, you know, where Northfield School District's been going through the budget, you know, process and looking at possible areas of cuts. Boy, did I deal with that issue in Worthington for 3 years. We were chronically dealing with that question, and, you know, kind of frankly dealing with the levy referenda questions to help supplement that formula. And it's a tough ask when you've got, you know, taxpayers that are feeling challenged and people that are, you know, on fixed incomes and folks whose agriculturally based, you know, income varies year to year, you know, trying to predict, you know, how the budget's going to look. So lots of interesting policy questions here. Some of this is probably for your Public Policy This Week show. You could devote a number of episodes, I think, to this and get some of the, you know, former legislators. I'm sure, you know, some of the guests you've got on that used to be in the legislature could talk at length about this issue.
Yeah, I'm sure they could. I'm sure they could. Justice Moore, is there anything else you'd like to mention while we have you on the air today?
Well, we had a good oral argument calendar in April. It wasn't a broad one, but we had two other roadshow cases, as we call them, one at the University of St. Thomas Law School and one at the University of Minnesota Law School involving criminal cases. At St. Thomas, we had State versus Torgerson, which we talked about a little bit last month. That's the question of whether law enforcement, if they smell an odor that they believe to be marijuana coming from a vehicle, do they have the ability to search the entire car under the Constitution? And then in the case of State versus Fordyce, we took a case involving an indecent exposure allegation that occurred in a small city in Crow Wing County involving a neighbor that saw allegedly her neighbor naked in his backyard. And, you know, is that conduct that's enforceable under the indecent exposure statute? And so the students at the U got to hear that. And both cases were really well argued. You know, they are cases that have importance, particularly the marijuana case, I think, is one that's being watched by the district courts and the law enforcement community carefully, because many traffic stops it get expanded because of the allegation of marijuana emanating from the car. Mm-hmm. And as our state has relaxed some of its policies on hemp and, you know, medicinal marijuana usage, it's becoming a little bit more of a challenging proposition to assume if you smell an odor that it's inherently illegal. And so, you know, I am not an expert in smokable hemp or medical marijuana, but we heard a lot about those topics, and we're going to be issuing decisions in due course on both of those cases.
All right. That was my next question, is have you decided on those?
No, yet? They are under review. And, you know, typically our calendar, we hope to get most of our work done by the end of July, the end of the term, although we're not like the U.S. Supreme Court generally doesn't adjourn until they have all the cases submitted done, and then they adjourn for a summer recess. We don't take a summer recess. We don't hear cases in July or August, though, to try to handle getting our opinions out, and that's when our law clerk term starts and ends at the 1st of August. And so we are going to have a robust June calendar, though sometimes June is a little quieter this year because April and May calendars were a little smaller. I think our June one is going to be 2 weeks. So when we come back in later May, I could talk to Rich a little bit about that, and mm-hmm. we'll see what's on the docket for June. But as always, Jeff, we encourage interested listeners to look at our website. Our cases are tracked. The Supreme Court Commissioner publishes issue summaries regarding the cases that are coming up, and you can watch the live stream of the oral argument, or you could wait and, you know, if you're interested in a particular case, you can watch it whenever you want to. We have an on-demand section of our mm-hmm. website as well for people that are real court nerds, I guess, or interested people.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for coming on today. Thank you for being patient with me, the guest host today. Oh, it's much appreciated.
Jeff, it's wonderful to be on. I appreciate KYMN's interest in all types of public policy issues, including those affecting the third branch of government, the judicial branch.
Well, thank you. Supreme Court Justice Gordon Moore.